Dina Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate for another edition of Democracy Now!
And you are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kbu.fm and on your mobile web at m.kbu.fm. The time is 4:59. Stay tuned for the Tuesday evening news. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, From Our Hands to Yours, celebrating 42 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from February 28th through Christmas Eve. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 25th Cascade Festival of African Films, happening Thursdays through Sundays, now through March 8th, in celebration of Black History Month at Portland Community College Cascade Campus. The theme this year is Africa Through African Lenses, and features the films Half of a Yellow Sun, Finding Fela, Lessons of Basketball and War, Under the Starry Sky, and many more. That's the 25th Cascade Festival of African Films at PCC Cascade, 705 North Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Women's Day this Sunday for live music from the KBOO studios from 7 to 10 p.m. Shirley Certain and Just Jess will host Annie Dang, Rachel Taylor Brown, and Butterfly Breakdown, as well as some recordings from the KBOO Live Music Archive. That's 7 p.m. this Sunday for International Women's Day.
Shake, 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 shake. Come on now and move your hips in. Shake, 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 shake.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a new report shows the extent of child poverty in Oregon.
Portland City audit reveals police use of force training falls short.
And activists call for a boycott of appliance manufacturer Whirlpool. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 3rd, 2015. I'm Jared Dantzler.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock. Training and policy changes at the Portland Police Bureau are quick and strong after high-profile incidents, but trail off over time, according to a city audit released earlier today. During a 2014 refresher course, auditors found that few officers could accurately recall the Bureau's current use of force policy, which was last updated in 2013. Auditors also found that use of force trainings focused more on discussions of litigated cases instead of actual Bureau standards for use of force. In several instances, trainings on new policies such as medical transport of suspects, handling of certain weapons and ammunition, and police car chases ceased after just 1 or 2 years. In the words of City Audit Services Director Drummond Kahn, "Any changes need to be sustained over the years. It takes continued emphasis to internalize any changes across the organization." Police Chief Larry O'Day agreed with Kahn and vouched for the Bureau's actions in response to audit recommendations. Police supervisors, however, noted the resource challenges required for consistent trainings of their 930-member force. Resource limitations have cut annual refresher trainings from 30 hours in 2014 to 20 hours. The cut has also prioritized sudden attack training scenarios over the disengagement and de-escalation techniques that speak to pressing issues of police force and mental illness.
Oregon's child poverty level would more than double without federal and state programs that are helping to keep many struggling families afloat. A new report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation draws that conclusion using updated poverty calculations just as the state legislature is debating funding for some of those programs. KABU's Mark Palmer has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Government safety net programs are keeping 153,000 children in Oregon above the federal poverty level. That's the finding of a new report that recommends using a more comprehensive poverty calculation from the U.S. Census Bureau, in addition to the federal poverty level standard. Laura Speer with the Annie E. Casey Foundation says together the two measures paint a more accurate picture of poverty and also whether enough is being done to fight it.
Using the supplemental poverty measure, we can really see the successes and the limitations of the safety net resources that we've put into place. We can also see that these resources don't go far enough. We still see that there are 13 million children below the poverty line.
The report says that even with the safety net programs, 14% of Oregon children live in poverty, but without them, the number jumps to 31%. The Oregon Center for Public Policy points out that the legislature hasn't updated the income limits in more than 20 years for the state's biggest anti-poverty program, temporary assistance to needy families, so fewer working families now qualify. More than 60 advocacy groups in Oregon are combining their efforts to improve the odds for lower-income children and families, calling their coalition United for Kids. Tanya Hunt with Children First for Oregon says it's important to have the best possible data to prioritize their work, and using a federal poverty level created in the 1960s is no longer enough.
We understand that food is no longer the most expensive part of our family budget. Oftentimes for families, it's child care and housing that cost so much. So our discussion about poverty and how we support families needs to reflect that.
This is Mark Palmer reporting for KBOO.
In the Oregon legislature today, the Senate Committee on Education heard testimony about several bills, including SB 84, which establishes statewide standards and funding mechanisms for accelerated college credit programs for high school students. Here's some of the testimony heard today, focusing on dual credit classes in which high school students can take courses that will count as college credit.
We have a great relationship with Mount Hood Community College. It used to be that our students were charged $35 a head for the dual credit courses, and that has been done away with. There is no charge for dual credit courses right now through Mount Hood Community College. We feel like not only are we preparing students, our high school students, for college courses, we're also preparing them for online courses. As you know, lots of universities and colleges now have online courses. And if students can take that already at the high school level, they're going to be prepared to take them and to succeed in them at the college level. We also are teaching them how to navigate the system. So every LMS is slightly different, every learning management system is slightly different, and yet if they've done it once, they're going to have a better chance of doing it well the second time when they get to the university level. Our students are mainly at risk. 60 to 70% of the students at our school would be considered at risk. I know Dr. Gray spoke to that earlier, but we have a lot of kids who come to us credit deficient, and we are helping them make that step from being behind to being ahead and being able to go to college. And without that opportunity, many of these kids aren't going to end up at college. So we feel like these dual credit classes are very important to their success.
Senator Roland, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Dentz, professor of political science at Eastern Oregon University and president of the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate. We represent the faculty of Oregon's public universities. There are several issues with Senate Bill 84's language that may inhibit its potential effectiveness. Senate Bill 84 stipulates, quote, faculty at post-secondary institutions of education will collaborate with teachers and school districts to ensure the quality of the accelerated learning program and to ensure alignment of the content, objectives, and outcomes of individual courses, end quote. This provision raises a range of academic quality and workload-related issues that may adversely impact Senate Bill 84 to benefit the best interest of our most valuable resource, our students. First, A number of Oregon's public universities have legally binding collective bargaining agreements protecting the best interest of both faculty and institution. Senate Bill 84's current language lacks specificity as to how faculty participation in accelerated learning programs, especially dual credit, will be integrated into the contractual workload of public university faculty in Oregon. Second, Senate Bill 84's dual credit provisions may have the potential to adversely affect academic quality in Oregon's public universities, as faculty may confront the need to dedicate more and more time to accelerated learning activities at the cost of their current students. Quote, ensuring the quality of accelerated learning programs, end quote, will be a time-intensive activity. Hence, a thoughtful consideration of the overlay between Senate Bill 84's goals and faculty resources necessary for success may be in need of further reflection and refinement.
SB 84 continues in the Senate Education Committee. Another bill considered today will require each public university, community college, or other institution of higher education to allow students, faculty, and staff to identify sexual orientation on forms used to collect demographic data.
Oregon students, teachers, and parents are planning a day of action this Friday at the Oregon State Legislature in Salem in support of a bill known as the Pay It Forward Bill for higher education funding. KBOO's Zachary Goff has more on this story.
This Friday, March 6th, the Oregon Legislature will be hosting its first public hearing on the Pay It Forward program. The Pay It Forward plan would allow students to attend colleges and universities in Oregon for free without taking out student loans. After graduating, students would be required to pay back into the public fund at a rate of 4% of their income. It would function a bit like Social Security. It's a public fund that pays for tuition and is supported by deductions from the income of people who benefited from the program. I spoke with Alejandro Juarez at the Working Families Party of Oregon, one of the partnering organizations working on the project. What is the Pay It Forward model?
Pay It Forward is a debt-free option for public higher education. It's an alternative to loans that we envision as something that can work with existing grant aid and other opportunities or other options to publicly finance education. And the way that it works is, you know, students attend college or university without tuition or fees in exchange for a small percentage of their future wages for a set period of time. The percentages that we worked out is after graduation, students, depending on how, whether they were in a 2-year or 4-year institution, would pay either 2% or 4% for 20 years. Given that the average person with a bachelor's graduates with $48,000 a year, or at least that's their maximum wage after they start working for a while, it ends up working out numbers-wise for the state. So the average is, you know, from a pool of participants, giving that money back to the state, and then that money is essentially earmarked for other students to attend school. So there's a fund for public higher education that's created out of Pay It Forward, and that pool of money pays for tuition and fees for other students. The biggest difference between Pay It Forward and a traditional student loan is that you don't have interest on, you don't pay interest on that loan. It's just a set percentage of your income that's income-based. So for example, a lot of graduates don't make their final wage, their maximum wage, until like 10 years after they graduate. So they have an entry-level job, and they will only pay, you know, 2 or 4% of their income based on their wage. With a traditional student loan, you have to qualify for that time for pay-as-you-earn or income-based repayment. The other thing is that the interest rates for loans, for example, if you take out $25,000, you can add almost $9,000 to that just based on interest. And that interest is something that doesn't come back to the state.
What's the origins of the Pay It Forward model? Where'd the idea come from?
The Pay It Forward model, as we see it in Oregon, came from a capstone course at Portland State University. The Oregon Working Families Party and organization founder in Oregon is Barbara Dudley, and she's an adjunct professor for Portland State University. And she taught a course on public higher education and student debt, alongside economist Mary King. And the students then were tasked with coming up with alternatives for solving the student debt crisis in Oregon. And, you know, as you know, Oregon is 47th in public education spending. The average graduate in Oregon graduates with $27,000 in student loan debt, and it's hampering our economy. The other thing is that you can't, in Oregon, we're very tax averse. So raising taxes is a very, very, very difficult proposition. And on top of that, you know, the way that our revenue is made, you know, like K through 12 competes with university students, or, you know, with public higher education for the same pool of money. So there has to be a way to figure out how to increase financing for public higher education without hampering any essential public services like schools and, you know, Medicare and anything like that. So when the students were researching their options, and they came up with an idea from the Economic Opportunity Institute in Seattle, which was Pay It Forward, that, you know, if you the state covers tuition up front, then, you know, students after they graduate would pay a small percentage of their wages for a set amount of time, seemed like a really good way to circumvent all of the politics and all of the gridlock around, you know, budgetary concerns, and actually create a self-sustaining fund for public higher education.
What stage is it in now, and how long will it be before it could be sort of viable in and of itself?
Well, last year we passed the Pay It Forward pilot study bill, which allowed the state to put resources into drafting a model that would potentially work with the existing revenue and with any, you know, trying to get all the legal kinks out of it. And we developed a draft that was recommended to the legislature in September. So right now we're trying to pass the Pay It Forward pilot, which would accommodate about 1,000 students. And we're asking the state for a $6 million initial investment with a $56 million total over a couple of years. So the first year will be $6 million, the next year will be $20 million, and increasing the number of students that can participate in the program. At the state that we're in right now, the legislature just started. The session just began. So we are actually just lobbying for the bill, and we're having our first hearing on Friday, March 6th at 8 a.m. So we're going to be driving from Portland bright and early at 6 a.m. to take supporters down to Salem to testify on behalf of the bill.
Alejandro Juarez of the Working Families Party of Oregon. If you want to support the bill and head to Salem, you can join the Working Families bus trip this Friday. Information can be found at workingfamilies.org. For KBOO News, I'm Zachary Goff.
Today, the Western Environmental Law Center filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Services Program, challenging its authority to kill endangered wolves in Washington state. The National Environmental Policy Act requires the government to prepare an in-depth environmental impact statement addressing the effects of employing wildlife services to kill endangered wolves in Washington. The agency completed a less detailed environmental assessment, but the document contains significant gaps and does not address specific issues that will significantly impact wolves and the human environment. The lawsuit is calling for a full environmental impact statement to be completed before the wolf killing is carried out. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with John Malgren of the Western Law Environmental Center.
Can you tell us about the lawsuit that your group filed today in Washington state?
Sure. Representing a number of nonprofit conservation groups, we sued a federal agency called Wildlife Services for their wolf management program in Washington. And what Wildlife Services does is they contract with government agencies to conduct wolf management, and basically that's how they describe wolf killing. So, for example, last summer they were hired by the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife to kill wolves in eastern Washington, and we believe that the environmental analysis that they prepared to justify that action is illegal. And so we sued Wildlife Services to try to force them to comply with federal law.
One of the things that I was surprised to read about in your lawsuit is that killing wolves actually does not decrease the amount of livestock killed by wolves. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Just in December of last year, a study came out of Washington State University that looked at what actually happens when you kill wolves after there are livestock wolf conflicts events. And what Dr. Wielgus out of Washington State found was that there's actually a greater incidence of livestock incidents after you lethally take wolves in a given wolf pack, and whether that's because of destabilizing pack structure or what, it's a little unclear. But it's clear that the result is that there's actually additional livestock depredation events after you kill wolves.
And what's the track record of Wildlife Services? I understand there's been some issues with them in the past.
Yeah, they don't have a very good track record, and in fact, right now the federal government is currently investigating them for a variety of reasons, due to incomplete and inadequate accounting, to their actual practices out in the field when they trap animals. And in fact, just a couple years ago, one of their agents took a bunch of photos of a coyote that he had trapped in a leg hold trap, so the coyote was still alive. And the pictures that he took and posted on Facebook were of his dogs attacking the coyote in the leg hold trap. And so, you know, it's just very inhumane treatment of animals throughout the system. And we think that there are some systematic problems with Wildlife Services. But again, our lawsuit is specific just to their Washington Wolf Management Program.
So Wildlife Services, is it a public agency?
It is a public agency. It's actually a part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and their mission, as they describe it, is to protect agricultural interests in this country. And so with the case of wolves, they're attempting to protect livestock producers who may have losses as a result of wolves being on the landscape.
But, in fact, their practices, as you argue, are having the opposite effect?
Yes, that's certainly what the science seems to be indicating right now.
And if your lawsuit is successful, what will the result be?
Well, that largely depends on what the judge does in the case. What our lawsuit is asking the court to do is to make Wildlife Services comply with the National Environmental Policy Act, and so they would be precluded from continuing with their wolf management program until they've completed the required environmental analysis and actually analyzed the true impacts of their program on the ecosystem in Washington.
And what's the current wolf population in the state of Washington?
So the wolf population, the most recent numbers that have come out from the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife are that there are 13 packs with at least 52 wolves.
And we will continue to follow this as this lawsuit progresses. Again, I've been speaking with John Melgren. He's with the Western Law Environmental Center. The group filed a lawsuit on behalf of five other environmental groups today to challenge the Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Services program on its authority to kill endangered wolves in Washington State. This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The Los Angeles police shooting of a homeless man on Skid Row Sunday continues to draw fire from the movement demanding greater police accountability. This morning, protesters marched from Skid Row to LAPD headquarters and demanded accountability. On the other side of town, a tract of land located around some of the city's wealthiest neighborhoods has become the focus of another struggle to provide shelter to the homeless, specifically homeless veterans. Los Angeles has the largest population of homeless veterans in the country, and some of those veterans are sleeping on the streets, just yards from the sprawling West LA VA campus. The VA sits on property that was donated in 1888 with the caveat that it used to provide housing for the veterans. But as FSRN's Lena Nozizwe reports, in spite of a win in recent litigation to reclaim the land service, men and women are still sleeping out in the cold.
I got cardboard down here that works as an insulator to keep it up, keep the moisture out.
Army veteran Donald Beyer says his descent into living on cardboard and on the streets started in 2007 after a four-month hospitalization. Disabled veteran Michael Aldrich says he's been on the streets much longer.
They keep running us back and forth out of the bars, so we're quite used to it. For 20 years I've been living on the street here.
Both Michael and Donald are sleeping on concrete and sand under a freeway bridge in the shadow of hundreds of acres of land that was placed in a charitable trust more than 125 years ago, expressly to house disabled veterans. The land, now known as the West L.A. Veterans Affairs Campus, was used for its intended purpose until the 1930s, about the same time President Herbert Hoover established the Veterans Administration. Then in the 70s, things at the West L.A. VA really started to change. There is still a VA hospital on the now nearly 400-acre parcel, and the VA says, in addition, a few hundred veterans do live there. But there are also empty buildings and lots of land that could be used to house many more veterans. Instead, part of the property is leased out to other entities. A laundry, a bird sanctuary, and a baseball stadium have all found homes there, while as many as 6,000 vets in Los Angeles remain homeless. For the past 7 years, Army veteran and activist Robert Rosebrock has led the Old Veterans Guard, a group of protesters at the West L.A. VA demanding the land be used for the purpose for which it was deeded.
After World War II, they housed and cared for some of them here, but all this area around here started getting developed, and you have some of the most affluent zip codes in the nation right here, right surrounding it. And prior to that, there was nothing here. And so what we've got today is everybody taking over the land here. It was deeded as a home for disabled soldiers, and that five times in the deed, to be permanently maintained as a national home for disabled soldiers. But we're the capital for homeless veterans.
Rosebrock says he doesn't understand why third parties remain on the property. In 2013, a federal judge ordered the leasing to stop because the occupants weren't providing veterans health care. And in January, the VA settled a land misuse lawsuit, agreeing to come up with a master plan that will determine how to create temporary and permanent housing for more vets on the property. Earlier this month, during a hearing of the Veterans Affairs House Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations, Chair Mike Kaufman echoed similar sentiments during a sharp exchange with Janet P. Murphy, the Veterans Health Administration's acting deputy undersecretary for health operations and management.
By 1888, when this land was bequeathed to the federal government, it was for the specific purpose of serving veterans. And so I don't understand why you have to go through some kind of bureaucratic process to determine when you're in violation of law, when you're already in violation of law. Can you explain that to me?
Well, I think, sir, in this instance, a very strong and well thought out master planning process could help us answer those questions.
You know, reading the law would help answer these questions.
I said they're training their baseball kids on stolen property.
From their vantage point in the streets, veterans Michael Aldrich and Donald Beyer have been closely following the litigation about the property. The court-ordered master plan is due in October. Lana Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
Supporters of Reverend Edward Pinckney called for a boycott of the appliance giant Whirlpool after a Michigan court refused to bond him out of prison until after the decision concerning his appeals made. Pinckney went up against the Benton Harbor mayor's office, who paved the way for the Whirlpool to do business without paying taxes and gave a loan to the company that residents would have to pay for. Benton Harbor has been gentrified extremely rapidly in recent years. The recall initiative was the second failed recall effort against Mayor Hightower because of handouts to Whirlpool. Reverend Edward Pinckney, leader of the group Banco, which stands for the Black Autonomy Network Community Organization, was denied bail, faces 10 years in prison for his role in the effort to legally recall Mayor James Hightower in October 2013. Reverend Pinckney and his fellow activists successfully put the recall on the ballot. As of February 2014, and Benton Harbor City Commissioner Marcus Muhammad planned to run after county clerks approved and verified at least 402 signatures out of the 700-plus that were submitted, well beyond the number of signatures necessary for the election to take place. 1 month before the recall election was to take place, Pinckney was accused of 5 counts of elections fraud and 6 counts of allowing persons to sign more than once. To counter this, Pinckney filed formal complaints against Mayor Hightower for trying to intimidate him and using the courts to derail a legitimate recall effort. Berrien County prosecutors would not press charges against Hightower, and the county offered up a stay in the recall election. After deliberation by a jury, a judicial order set the recall election for November 4, 2014. It never happened because the judicial order was overturned by the Court of Appeals. The state refused to hear the appeal of the petitioners, and the recall effort died. Pinckney remains in jail and faces 2.5 to 10 years in prison. Tampering, i.e. changing the dates on petition signatures, would normally be characterized as a misdemeanor. Person after person testified that they had changed the dates themselves after realizing they put the wrong date down. Still, the prosecution wants to charge Pinckney with felony forgery. Supporters of Pinckney want people to call Whirlpool at 1-866-698-2538 to ask them to use their considerable political influence to free Pinckney.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the Tuesday Evening News.
Greetings, you're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. As I mentioned last week, I just returned from another teaching trip to the Midwest. On my final night there, I gave a speech in Minneapolis on how the community rights strategy of local lawmaking might be the perfect complementary movement to help the climate protection movement to become a lot more effective than it is currently. On my commentaries today and again next Tuesday, I'm going to share some thoughts about climate change and community rights. Climate activism continues to build in numbers across the country, but in my opinion, it continues to be mostly ineffective because it continues to assume that if we just build a large enough group of people willing to pressure our so-called leaders to do the right thing at the state and federal level, and if we all buy more and more green products, we'll solve this serious problem before it's too late. I think we need to be a lot bolder than that, and soon. In my speech, I recommended a rapid revving up of local communities passing enforceable community rights ordinances that would, for example, ban coal and oil trains from passing through their towns, as Columbia County, Oregon hopes to do later this year through the ballot box, or prohibiting any future increases in the number of flights at local airports, or prohibiting local banks from making any more investments or loans for new fossil fuel-related developments. We need to start understanding that we are the leaders we've been waiting for, and what we can already successfully accomplish locally with a community rights strategy could crack this movement wide open. So let's get cracking. In preparation for my speech, I recently read Naomi Klein's breathtaking new book, This Changes Everything, which I urge everyone to read. Here's a lengthy quote from her book that I included in my speech. I denied climate change for longer than I care to admit. I knew it was happening, sure. Not like Donald Trump and the Tea Partiers going on about how the continued existence of winter proves it's all a hoax. But I stayed pretty hazy on the details and only skimmed most of the news stories, especially the really scary ones. I told myself the science was too complicated and that the environmentalists were dealing with it. And I continued to behave as if there was nothing wrong with the shiny card in my wallet, attesting to my elite frequent flyer status. A great many of us engage in this kind of climate change denial. We look for a split second, and then we look away. Or we look, but then turn into a joke. More signs of the apocalypse, which is another way of looking away. Or we look, but tell ourselves comforting stories about how humans are clever and will come up with a technological miracle that will safely suck the carbon out of the skies or magically turn down the heat of the sun, which is yet another way of looking away. Or we look, but try to be hyper-rational about it. Dollar for dollar, it's more efficient to focus on economic development than climate change, since wealth is the best protection from weather extremes. As if having a few more dollars will make much difference when your city's underwater, which is a way of looking away if you happen to be a policy wonk. Or we look, but tell ourselves we're too busy to care about something so distant and abstract,
even though we saw the water in the subways in New York City and the people on the rooftops in New Orleans, and know that no one is safe, the most vulnerable least of all. And though perfectly understandable, this too is a way of looking away. Or we look but tell ourselves that all we can do is focus on ourselves, meditate, shop at farmers markets, and stop driving, but forget trying to actually change the systems that are making the crisis inevitable, because that's too much bad energy and it will never work. And at first it may appear as if we're looking, because many of the lifestyle changes are indeed part of the solution, but we still have one eye tightly shut. Or maybe we do look, really look, but then inevitably we seem to forget. Remember and then forget again. Climate change is like that. It's hard to keep it in your head for very long. We engage in this odd form of on-again, off-again ecological amnesia for perfectly rational reasons. We deny because we fear that letting in the full reality of this crisis will change everything, and we are right. We know that if we continue on our current path of allowing emissions to rise year after year, climate change will change everything about our world. We don't have to do anything to bring about this future. All we have to do is nothing. Just continue to do what they're doing now, whether it's counting on a techno fix or tending to our gardens or telling ourselves we're unfortunately too busy to deal with it. All we have to do is not react as if this is a full-grown, blown crisis. All we have to do is keep on denying how frightened we actually are. And then bit by bit, we will have arrived at the place we most fear, the thing from which we have been averting our eyes, no additional effort required. There are ways of preventing this grim future, or at least making it a lot less dire, but the catch is that these also involve changing everything. Unquote. Next week, I'll share some more thoughts about climate change and community rights, and I'll be presenting my full speech again on the evening of May 14th at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland, so please hold that date. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and now also in Viroqua, Wisconsin on WDRT every Tuesday at 7 p.m. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can follow me on Twitter at cienfuegospaul. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcienfuegos.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Out Loud at 6. This week on Out Loud, the Clackamas Community College Theater Director, James Zykrom, will be joining us to discuss their production of The Laramie Project. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear, with a low around 32. Tomorrow's weather will be CAVU, which is aviation speak for ceiling and visibility unlimited, with a high near 58 degrees Fahrenheit. Today in history, in 1931, the Star Spangled Banner was adopted as the national anthem. And in 1991, Rodney King's vicious beating by Los Angeles police officers was caught on videotape. The quote of the day is quite Orwellian. "The atom bombs are piling up in the factories. The police are prowling through the cities. The lies are streaming from the loudspeakers, but the earth is still going round the sun."
It's 5:37, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Come one, come all. Step right up and buy your ticket for a ride on the splendiferous, phantasmagoric, supersonic, miraculous, trans-Pacific partnership. TPP is not some sort of futuristic flying machine, but yet another global trade scam coming at us like a volcanic eruption straight out of hell.
This thing is a partnership of, by, and for global corporations, similar to NAFTA, only much, much, much bigger and far more destructive, both to the middle class and to our people's sovereignty. Negotiating in strict secrecy during the past 7 years, a cabal of the Obama White House and corporate lobbyists are now ready to spring it on us, and Republican leaders intend to ram it into law before we, the people, can get a whiff of its anti-democratic stench. Indeed, to perfume it, they've already begun a PR campaign touting TPP as the long-sought wonder cure for America's downtrodden working class. For example, such odd bedfellow boosters as Secretary of State John Kerry and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce both exclaim that the 12-nation scheme will, quote, support 650,000 new jobs. Wow, really? No. In January, the Washington Post fact-checker column dug into that number and found that it was miscalculated and misleading. In fact, the columnist found that, quote, the correct number is zero. He also pointed out that even if 650,000 jobs were created, that's not even a drop in the bucket, for it would increase U.S. employment by less than one-half of 1%. This is Jim Hightower saying, be alert, friends, for the TPP gang will try to dazzle us with hokey numbers and neon lies while they turn our future well-being over to global corporations. To get information and get involved, go to citizen.org/trade.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
March 11 marks the fourth anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear accident. Scientists and environmentalists are concerned that a similar accident could occur here in the U.S. The Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant near San Luis Obispo, California, has been the target of protests since the 1980s. Now, a federal appeals court is allowing a suit to proceed, which could shut down the plant for good. KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh talked with Damon Moglen, a spokesman for Friends of the Earth, to find out more.
So, could you give us some background first about the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant down near San Luis Obispo?
Well, Diablo Canyon is probably the most dangerous nuclear power plant in the United States. It's built in a place that has a huge array of earthquake faults. Plant could never be built at that site now, and yet we're allowing a plant designed and constructed, at least at first in the 1960s, to be operating despite the fact that we know that there are these very powerful earthquake faults that literally surround the plant. We now know that there are four faults surrounding the plant, which are capable of far more ground motion than the plant was designed to withstand.
Now, you folks at Friends of the Earth have been working for quite some time to raise awareness about the issues surrounding Diablo Canyon. You've just gotten a victory in a court of appeals. Could you tell us something about that?
Absolutely. It came out in September of 2014 that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had allowed Pacific Gas and Electric to secretly and illegally change their operating license for Diablo Canyon. And what they did is they actually changed the seismic licensing basis for the plant, and they did so in order to make it look as though the plant is capable of withstanding more powerful earthquakes that we now know are possible at the plant. Under the NRC's own rules and under the federal law, those changes should have been subjected to a full public review before a panel of independent judges and with an opportunity for the public to be involved and to get access to information. And instead, the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, allowed PG&E to do this license change in secret. And it's completely unacceptable. We went before the Court of Appeals and asked that they review this decision, which we believe was done against their own rules, and that we've asked that not only should they send the decision back so that it was done the right way, we've asked that in the meantime the plant be shut down until such time and unless the plant can be proven to be safe.
So where does it go from here? The decision is to allow this, allow the complaint to proceed. Does it go on in court? And what kind of a timeline are you looking at?
Well, right now the Court of Appeals had said that they wanted the case to be briefed and that there would be oral arguments. Once again, PG&E and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission are now throwing up procedural hurdles and trying to stop the case from actually being heard in court. We're hopeful that the court will dismiss these objections and demand that the utility and PG&E move on and allow us to actually have the argument. We're hopeful that there's going to be briefing before the court within the next few months and that the decision will be taken again in these next few months. We think that this is critically important. We are really afraid that a major earthquake in the area around Diablo could absolutely be devastating and could lead to a kind of catastrophic nuclear accident like we saw at Fukushima.
The same kind of level, worse? Any idea?
Well, you know, it's terrible to even think about these things, but the fact is this is an extremely old, decrepit nuclear plant built in the 1960s, and there are two reactors there, and there's a great deal of irradiated nuclear fuel, the nuclear waste that comes out of the power plant, lying there. So whereas, you know, you had a devastating disaster with three meltdowns at Fukushima, we have only two reactors at Diablo, and yet there's so much nuclear material there that if an accident were to lead to even a fraction of that radiation to enter into the environment, it would be an absolutely devastating accident. Depending on which way the wind blows, radiation released from a Diablo Canyon nuclear disaster could affect hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people in central and then southern California on the coast.
Wow. So now, how can people find out more about this case, about what Friends of the Earth is doing?
Well, certainly I'd encourage people to go to Friends of the Earth's website. That's www.foe.org. We make sure that all of the material that we publish, all of the court documents that we file and respond to are all up on our website. We think that one of the key issues here really is about transparency and democracy. Normal people have every right to understand what the risks of nuclear power are and to make decisions about do they want to accept those risks or do they want to have clean, safe,